Well, thank you all for coming out. We're just going to go ahead and start with a prayer to get us going here. So, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
So I know that some of this might be familiar to some of you to various degrees, so we're going to do a brief sort of summary, though, of Humani Vitae and what it's saying, its various parts, and then we're going to get into the question, the predictions, but also the sort of application and how that works for us and for what NFP means and this sort of thing as we go along, okay? So, but I think it's important to have that sort of common baseline where to begin, okay? So
I think the first thing to note is the background where Humani Vitae kind of splashed into history. In July of 1965, there was a Gallup poll asking Catholic Americans whether or not they thought the birth control pill would be given the green light by Vatican for Catholics to use. And 61% of them said yes. 3 years later, it was no, right? After Humani Vitae was released, about 2,000 demonstrators, mostly priests and religious, but also laity, gathered at Catholic University to publicly voice their dissent from this teaching of the Church. And so this is the background. In the 1930s, it was actually Margaret Sanger of Planned Parenthood, abortion euthanasia fame, that kind of got the ball rolling, called for something like the pill to be created. And around the same time, most Christian churches agreed that it was a bad idea. In the 1930s, though, the Anglican Church at the, and I always say this wrong, the conference's name?
Lambeth.
Doesn't sound right to me. The Lambeth Conference stated that it was okay to use in marriage, especially for those with economic reasons to use the pill. So this was kind of the splash part, the break point, if you will, into most Christians then, by the late 1960s, being completely okay with this, or at least giving sort of some homage to, it's okay in some circumstances, but we're not going to check, right? And so this is where we were. But still in 1966, in U.S. News and World Report, back, you know, when newspapers were the social media, there were still articles out about, you know, how it's going to increase promiscuity, that this is still something that's being debated. But that voice died out pretty quickly thereafter, leaving just the Catholic Church to stand up for what I view is true and what is true. So Humani Vitae. We should give a background of that. Humani Vitae is in three parts. So the first part, Pope Paul VI issued this in 1968. In the first part, he discusses the cultural background, the questions that's being put before him. Okay. In the second part, he discusses the theological, the anthropological background, the context for his answer, and gives his answer. And in part three, he makes one really important point we're going to get to about self-mastery, and then appeals to groups, appeals to scientists in part. And so we'll go into that. Do you want to do part one?
Sure, I can do that. So it's important to understand that as the Church was considering what to do with birth control, that you have this big social movement in the 1960s, sort of fomenting change in various ways. And the expectation had already been driven. There was a pontifical birth control commission sort of that was assembled, and they were sort of asked their opinions. These are experts in various fields. And the Pope said, okay, I want you to get together, write your recommendations. What do we do with this sort of information, and what should the Church say? Well, this group got together, and they came up with these findings, but these findings were leaked to the press, starting in London and in the U.S., in the months prior to the encyclical. Now, the hard part of this is you have this leak of what people expect. You also have this coming out some 8 years after the pill had actually been on the market. Before, it was, you know, the Lambeth Conference and other things were talking about other forms of contraception like condoms. Now you have the pill that's been out and been used by Catholics and others for some 8 years and had changed how they view sex and how they integrate it into their lives. And now you have the church responding, and then, you know, you get this anticipation in the media that, well, here's going to be the result. And then Paul VI says, no. You can imagine how well this is going to be received.
Against the findings. So the findings, that the recommendation of the commission was actually, yes, you should allow this. And Pope Paul VI, in his wisdom, then came out and said, no, we're not going to allow this.
Right. Yeah. Right. And he lays out, you know, listen, the modern times, we're going through so much upheaval and there's so much going on. But there's been this rapid increase in population that everybody's worried about. And there's how we view women, how we view society. But we have to understand all those are issues that are driving this change. But what hasn't changed is who we are as human beings. And we have to understand that while the social conditions have changed, who we are fundamentally hasn't. And that's why in part one he lays out, you can imagine this would be a really tough document to write if you already have the Pontifical Birth Commission and its findings sort of being out publicly, that on the one time he can't sort of throw them under the bus, right, for coming up with all the wrong conclusions, and he sees that the broader church is changing, but at the same time he feels the weight of his office and what he's got to proclaim. This first section would be a profoundly hard thing to write, I think. It's someone trying to console his children in a way that says, I'm with you, but we've got issues, and we need to address them. And here's what's really the case. And I'm going to lay this out. I'm not doing it in a scolding way, but we've got to face the hard reality of what's really here.
Okay. So then in part two, he gets into the theological, anthropological, what it is about us as humans that drives his decision. And this is where you have all heard, most of your familiar faces, so I know you've heard sex is unitive and procreative, right? Those two kind of things kind of hammered in. These two things came from this document, or at least it was most put forward in this document, okay? And so he says, you have to have sex being unitive and procreative, and those can't be separated on either side, right? Now, at the time, this is shouldn't have been a huge splash because it is actually in line with previous documents that had been released. So what was anticipated was that the Vatican was actually going to change this, right, not keep it the same. But it shouldn't have been too much of a surprise because there are several documents, Dona Vitae Castae Canubi, that, past papal encyclical documents and releases that had emphasized this fact. But this is where we see it written out as the why, right? Now, we, at this time, didn't have John Paul II, right, because he was a couple popes later. But we can see that very much reflected, laid out, much more clearly drawn out in a way that speaks to all of our hearts in Pope John Paul II when he talks about how sex has to be, right, free, total, faithful, and fruitful.
Right, and the one thing here that about this unitive and procreative, this isn't the first time the Church had used this language, of course, in its tradition. Some of this had come from as far back as Augustine, and then it comes through Castae Canubi. But what had changed here, or what people thought that there was going to be an opening, was that our sexual relationships need to be procreative and unitive. Our marriages need to be procreative and unitive. And so they were operating under this idea of what is called this principle of totality. Right? As long as your whole marriage is open, then an individual act could be procreative or an individual act could be unitive. And you could sort of choose which one you wanted it to be, or maybe they're both. Right, and the language here, definitively, what Paul VI said was focused. No, each act has to be both. It's intrinsic to the nature of the act, not intrinsic to the nature of the marriage. Right, and that's what he sort of came, asserted, which is absolutely really necessary. Because if it was just sort of indicative of the marriage and not the act, well, then in theory you could have zero acts that were either one the whole time. Right? Somehow, right? But that would be perfectly fine, because if it's just an accidental to the individual act, then technically zero acts have this. And so this is the only way that really makes sense But that doesn't mean that that's what people expected, right? You want to talk about NFP or how this is?
Yeah. So one of the questions that often gets raised for NFP is, well, how is that any different from the pill, right? And on the other hand, well, how could you even use NFP? Because that's, you know, that's just taking it into your hands, and we should let it be in God's hands, right? And those seem like they're the same argument, but they end up on two different sides, two different groups of people making those arguments. So NFP, natural family planning, right, intends to read the woman's cycle, right? And this is what the Pope says is the difference between it. So give me a second. I'm going to read it to you because it's short and to the point. The Church is not inconsistent when it teaches both that it's morally permissible for spouses to have recourse to infertile periods, as NFP does, and also that all directly contraceptive practices are morally wrong. The two situations are essentially different. In the first, the spouses legitimately use a faculty that's given by nature. In the second case, the spouses impede the order of generation from completing its own natural processes. So in this, the Pope is being incredibly scientific, right? He's saying, well, this is what nature shows us, right? So we can use what nature shows us. God has given us the ability to rationalize from what's in front of us, right? And we can use that natural process that he's given us. We wouldn't have recourse to that if, like males, women were fertile all the time, right? But in his graciousness, God has given us this ability to have times of both fertility and infertility.
So, and then the final part of this section, he simply talks about how it's the Church. What's the Church's job? The Church's job is not to bend to sort of what we want to change, but just to enunciate, here's who we are as men and women, and this is the challenge before us. Right, that leads into the third part where it's like, really, how do we address this challenge? But, you know, he really wants to say we need to preserve the moral law of marriage. That's the Church's job, is to preserve what marriage authentically is. And that's what we ought to witness to, because that's what really fosters the growth of an authentic and true civilization.
Oh, I made a mistake. I didn't finish the quote. I was like, something feels missing, and it is. Here's the end. You guys, you should have known when you asked me to do this. Okay. Since the church did not make either of these laws, okay, she can't change them. What is immoral is by its very nature always opposed to the true good of human beings. And I think that's the most poignant part. So, read it again. What's immoral is by its very nature always opposed to the true good of human beings. By preserving the whole moral law of marriage, the Church knows that she's supporting the growth of a true civilization. And that's in paragraph 18 of Humanae Vitae, because you should go and read this.
Right. Go ahead. So in section 3, I think, is a really important sort of initial point he makes. And this gets at the philosophical presuppositions that people have. At the very beginning, he leads with self-mastery is possible. Well, the whole question about whether it's possible or not is predicated on a conclusion that self-mastery is, in fact, a good thing. And simply, that's not what we get from a good portion of society. We get that, you know, going, and this isn't something new, this isn't throwing pop culture under the bus alone. But, you know, we go back to David Hume in the 1700s, the atheist philosopher in England, who argues we have these whole thing of monkish virtues that really fundamentally get in the way of who we are as people, because all virtue should be defined as how socially, you know, well-adjusted we are, right? How well we can promote societal well-being by hosting parties and doing this, and that's what he wants to measure virtue as. That it doesn't have to do with humility or, you know, any of these gross, ugly old things like self-mastery, right? The idea that you can control your urges, well, that gets in the way of, I don't know, your local kegger, right? And so we need to get rid of that. We need real, authentic virtue. That's sort of how Hume takes it. And so Paul VI just rightly says, this is possible. But we have to understand, saying this is possible to people today seems like you're speaking a different language. Maybe it's possible, but why would I even want it? If we can't get people on sort of that page, well, then this is made a lot harder, right? And I think that's a real challenge for all of us.
And if you talk with most medical professionals today, I think you'll find, at least when I talk to the ones in my family, they'll say, well, you know, NFP is great for people that are, like, super convinced of it, but those other people, like, they're just going to do it anyways, so we should make them capable of protecting themselves, right? And what a travesty that is. When what we ought to be elevating is, no, you guys, this is possible. You can do it. Imagine telling a teenager that, right? Instead of taking teen boys and giving them a talk about, well, here's how to use a condom because we know you're going to do it anyways, so you might as well do it the safe way, even though it's not that safe, and we can get into that, right? We say instead, hey, you know what? It sucks, but you can do it, and you're going to be better for it, right?
And it's interesting that Paul VI, you know, concludes the document, well, this sort of portion of the document, with this appeal to doctors.
Yeah. He acknowledges, and I think the commission's whole point, right, they're trying to be faithful, right? Their whole point was, what are we offering the faithful then? There wasn't anything. Back in this day, they really did only have the rhythm method, which was, well, on average, a woman's cycle is about 28 days long, which would mean she ovulates on day 14, so just avoid around day 14 and see what happens. Well, that's great when it works, but it doesn't work for every woman every cycle. It doesn't even work for any one woman all the time, right? And so what the church was asking of women in the 1950s, I mean, can you imagine not having NFP, right? Like most of you out there, I think, are probably using NFP at some point in your marriage. Imagine not having that at all as a recourse. Well, this was the situation. My grandmother had 5 kids and 4 miscarriages over the course of a marriage where her husband went and fought in 3 wars, right? So you can imagine how quickly in succession she was having kids, and she was trying to use the rhythm method, but it didn't always work for her, right? And so they had to stick beds together and, you know, make things work, right? In military housing, etc. You can imagine the story. So what Pope Paul VI says is, look, we're not going to let science's limitations dictate what's morally right. We base science on philosophy, right? We base science on theology. We need those guidelines to take science by the hand and show it, here's the lines you can color in, right? But that doesn't mean that science is impoverished by that. It should be enriched by that and in a way set free by that. And so he calls forth all of the scientists in this document, spends the entire third portion speaking to educators, speaking to politicians, speaking to scientists, speaking to healthcare providers, and says, look, you guys need to do better. We're calling you out. You need to provide something because these women do deserve something better. So let's focus on that and actually put some money into it instead of the pill, right?
It's actually just to extemporaneously go for a second, that's a pretty common status for a lot of encyclicals in the 20th century. It's something new. You don't really get that from papal documents earlier on. But all of a sudden they're like, listen, people who are experts at this, we're not. You got to do your job better. We need this. As Christians, the whole church needs you to do your job well, wherever that is. Right? And Paul VI certainly follows this up, and it's a great call. I mean, John Paul writes letters to artists, etc., you know, sort of doing the same thing, right? This embrace of where you are. This isn't a letter just, you know, for certain people or whatever, but it's a challenge to the entire Christian community, I think is a beautiful part of this.
And what's great is that all of the methods that we have around here, they find their origins in scientists who read this. Catholic scientists who responded and said, oh, wait, that's me. They're talking to me. And then they responded. That's why, if you've ever heard of, like, you know, a NAPRO and the Pope Paul VI Institute, that's why they named it that, because they were responding to Pope Paul VI's call in this document. And so they continue that work. And I think it's important to note that that's not done, right? There's probably even more that could be done in the realm of developing things for women, for couples, to understand their fertility. And, you know, but that's how he kind of ends part 3. And then he makes some predictions And these are fun to look back on. We just had the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, and so there was a lot done with these predictions. And a lot of people focused on the three or four, depending how you dice them, negative predictions, but there's a positive one, and I think that's the best one of all. So we'll go through the negative ones first.
Sure. And this is a little bit hard to claim. A lot of people like to focus on this, and they go, well, because this, we embrace this contraceptive mentality, therefore we have this sort of effect. We should be honest, it's not always that easy. There are multiple causes. There's a whole myriad of social changes going on. And it's hard to say, well, because you use contraception, because society embraces contraception, therefore we have this effect. That's a hard line to draw historically. But we can say something that it surely hasn't contributed to a healthy solution, right? We can at least make a negative claim in that way, right? We can't necessarily draw all the positive connections. Well, the first one that he mentions is that there's just a general rise in infidelity and moral decline in a broad sort of way. I don't think it takes too much to see this, but of course there were other trends going on at the time that you could trace. You know, is it how much is the response of no-fault divorce laws, or how much is the response is due to something else? I don't know. That we probably will never know, but this didn't help eliminate that either.
Okay. And people that were pushing for what we would consider infidelity and moral decline in a negative way, that they were pushing for it as a freedom or a right, also saw the pill as the means to that freedom and right, which strengthens that argument.
Right.
And that would be, again, like the sexual revolution proponents, those who are proponents of the abortion industry and that sort of thing. The second negative prediction that he made is a lost respect for women. He said, look, if you make the woman take this pill, you're shouldering her, or you're burdening her shoulders with the responsibility of fertility, right? You're making this all on her. And men, because they don't have the nice social repercussion of getting the girl pregnant, no longer care, right? So they're just going to go for it. I mean, that's basically what he says in not so many terms. He's going to say, look, it's just too tempting. So there's going to be a lost respect for women, and I think we can see that. Again, it's been the result of multiple things, but I think that that's there,
right.
And I think that we can probably see a temptation to that even in every marriage that's not necessarily using NFP properly. Like, this is something that's a temptation in all of us,
yeah.
Right? That there's this, well, I mean, you do all the chart, you know, like NFP's not immune from this, I guess is what I'm trying to say. There can be something that says, look, you're the gateway to telling me yes or no, and I can just ask, like, oh, why can't we have sex? We can have sex. Come on, I want to have sex, you know, right? And become like a man child, you know? And so in some ways, if we not, he doesn't do that. And make the woman the, like, the gatekeeper for the NFP method. And that is also a travesty. And all the NFP methods that we have here in the diocese have guards in place. They have educational systems in place to prevent that from happening even there. But it was, I think, a very legitimate prediction that he made. There would be a lost respect for women if the pill of birth control got used in that way.
Right. And I think, you know, John Paul talks about this a lot in terms of objectification. Right, taking subjective values of persons and all of a sudden turning them into an object for consumption, or, you know, this is what this is. I think this also leads to marriages being considered like this. I think we have a fundamental, like, diminution of sort of our valuation of things. I think it becomes a kind of, we see marriage as a contract where you get what you want out of it and I get what I want out of it. Not that she does this, but this is the temptation in our society. As long as you both get what you want, right, it sees it fundamentally as a zero-sum kind of game. That there's simply, there's $100 and it gets to be split up between you and you. And sometimes it may go all to one or all to the other, or you just need to negotiate it. But it sees it fundamentally as this, a battle that's sort of pitched against one another. It changes it to a negotiation rather than an invitation. And I think that's a fundamentally different look, because who's the principal agent? The agent is either the two spouses who have to make it in this crazy world and they have to figure it out for themselves, or it's God inviting them to trust him and seeing how much he wants to do with your life. That fundamentally changes how you view what your relationship ought to be.
And then the third negative prediction that he makes is that there would be an abuse of power and unlimited dominion. One of the things he points out in part one is that this document is coming out in an environment where people are learning more and more about how to control different things about their body, and that they are wanting to extend that to their fertility as well. And so in this, he says, okay, look, you know, if we just sort of let the pill loose, what's going to happen is there's going to be abuse of power, i.e. in the realm of nations, right, which we see. The World Health Organization is very much a proponent of limiting family size in different areas as a means to eliminate poverty in that area, right? And nations like the United States frequently will hold aid packages hostage, quote-unquote, to allow in some of those, like, safe-sex contraceptive programs into the country if they also want food and medicine, right? So we see this all the time. And then we also see this unlimited dominion, not just on a national level, but on a personal level. You have things like in vitro fertilization, a feeling like I get to choose how many children I want to have, at what time I should have them, and anything short of that is science failing me, or right. You know, something along those lines. I feel like I painted that very crassly.
Well, it's like, you know, why shouldn't I get to choose what syndrome, you know, that my children aren't affected by Down syndrome, or why shouldn't I get to choose what gender they are? Why not? If marriage is fundamentally about us and what we want for our children, then we should get to select them,
yeah.
Right? It changes it, right? It's all about this economic model. Almost in a way is what marriage becomes about. But there is this positive prediction, and I want to read this in full quote. The discipline which is proper to the purity of married couples, far from harming conjugal love, rather confers on it a higher human value. It demands continual effort, yet, thanks to its beneficent influence, husband and wife fully develop their personalities, being enriched with spiritual values. Such discipline bestows upon family life fruits of serenity and peace, and facilitates the solution of other problems. It favors attention for one's partner, helps both parties to drive out selfishness, the enemy of true love, and deepens their sense of responsibility. That's really profound, I think, this quote. It's a lot harder and much more worth it, right, is what Paul VI is challenging people to. This is actually, this is hard for us to understand. I remember being married about 2 years and struggling with NFP and thinking about, like, what exactly is it supposed to look like? And I kept realizing that in my own head, I knew, like, we have this demand to be generous, right? We should be as generous as we possibly can be. And yet we have this demand to be responsible adults now. Right? That's where we found ourselves. We got married. I was 26. Christy was 22. And so we need to be fully generous and yet somehow really responsible. How is that supposed to work? That seems really hard. And then I thought about it while I was talking and we were praying about it. And it dawned on me, like, these things aren't like you do one and then you do the other. That fundamentally what is truly generous is being this responsible adult. And what's really responsible is being profoundly generous. And that these things mutually inform one another, thus allowing it to grow out of this, like, finite sum kind of idea. It allows it to fundamentally become a much bigger pot by way of being fully responsible and fully generous at the same time. I think that's sort of what Paul VI is pointing here in this final paragraph. That's hard for us because it does require trust. It requires it requires faith to say, I'm not sure how this is going to work. But nevertheless, we find ourselves having another child, you know, or whatever the case may be.
And I think it's really neat to note that he was kind of doing that with issuing this document as well, right? How often is it that a pope goes against the recommendations of the commission that he put together, you know, and doesn't have anything else to offer women except to call for the experts to do something and quick, right? And yet he steps out in faith in that sweeping generosity and responsibility to give us this. So he stands in it with us. which I think is also beautiful. And JP2 does exactly the same thing. I wanted to point out, so it talks about, hold on, I want to find it in here. So it talks about discipline, right? The discipline of self-mastery. It's talking about periods of abstinence, right? They are hard. And when I meet with NFP couples, in every single engaged couple that I have, I sit them down and I'm like, so being engaged sucks because you have promised with your heart what you can't promise with your body yet, but you want to really bad, right? And it's really bad English, but so you want to do that, right? And I think that more than once, I've had a couple look at me and be like, you're the first person to acknowledge that. You know, like, to out loud. Like, we can talk about that, you know? And that opens a door. And I think sometimes NFP gets painted as something that is a panacea, right? It's going to be great. You're going to love it, right? And for those of you that are married and using NFP, know that that's not true, right? At all. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it helps you to conceive the child that you've been wanting for a really long time, and it is absolutely gorgeous in that circumstance, but even that requires some abstinence, right? But NFP is just a tool, right? It's just knowledge about your cycle. So when we say that NFP is great, what we're really saying is that discipline is great, right? It's a lot harder to paint that as great, so we say NFP, but it's important to note that this promise he makes, that discipline bestows upon family life fruits of serenity and peace, and facilitates the solution of other problems. How? Well, because discipline, right? And that's a lot, that's the root of a lot of our problems. At least that's the root of a lot of my problems. And it favors attention to one's partner, helps both parties drive out selfishness, right? It's the very fact that NFP is built on periods of abstinence that makes it hard. And it's the very fact that it's hard and built off of a discipline that makes it amazing. Because there really is like a 97% like success rate, 3% divorce rate among couples that practice NFP, right? That's a staggering, that's the most highly correlated statistic of what, like the best predictor of what keeps a marriage together is if they use natural family planning. Well, you know, and still use natural family planning. And I think that's key, right? Like, you didn't just try it and then abandon it, but, like, you had to stick it out. Well, of course, because it's discipline. It's good for you, right? And so, of course, it's going to help your marriage. So I want to acknowledge, just in case none of you have heard it before, NFP is hard, and that's okay. So if you're using NFP and you're finding it difficult, you are in great company. We are with you. But we want to, I want to note anyways, that in trying to follow Humanae Vitae, right, we're saying, okay, let's give it to you, Pope Paul VI, you predicted everything beautifully, right? I think one of the questions as we walk away from this is how to live that out, okay? And I think that if you've heard of SPICE, most of the NFP methods these days use it, right? That you're more than just the genital contact between you and your husband and wife, right? You don't have both. You have one. But it's spiritual, physical, intellectual, creative, and emotional, right? Or communicative. So spiritual, physical, intellectual, creative, or communicative, and emotional. That there is part of you that you can still be generous in, even in periods of abstinence. Do not just be like, nope, don't touch me. Roll away from each other and like go to sleep. That's not what we want, right? What we want is to encourage there to still be growth. So one of the questions that I would send you home with is, how can you do that? And I don't care if you're married or single, you can answer this question, right? What can you do to help encourage growth in those five arenas in your relationships with others, especially if you're married with your spouse? And did you have questions too?
So, yeah, just this idea of NFP as a tool, SPICE as a tool, the church sort of offers in various ways. Of course, this isn't to say that couples who want to just have, you know, trust the Lord and have as many children as the Lord provides, that's perfectly fine. The church doesn't say anything that somehow that's wrong, right? It's simply a matter of they choose other tools, other things by which to raise their family, by which to help their children grow in holiness, right? Offering one suggestion, offering one way, it's not, you know, sort of definitory and you have to use it or something like this. In fact, of course, and you know, the vast majority of couples, I would imagine, who use NFP, well, there are periods of using it and there are periods of not. You know, if finances turn around and there are other things and there are other sort of situations, then okay, maybe we're not going to use NFP, but we have to discern that for a while, and then we'll go back to using it. It depends on, you know, a whole host of factors. So we have a couple questions that we wanted to throw out to you at the end here.
I think so. Yeah, well, those were two of them. And then if you want a big one, you run out of something to say, what is essential about being a man and what's essential about being a woman and why does God care about sex? Would be great questions. And then a great one to kick that off with would be, so it seems like a lot of the feminists got it wrong. Can you be Catholic and be feminist at the same time? And if so, what does that look like? That's also a great conversation starter. So that's what we were told to give you. So now you have them. Thank you. I don't know this for sure, but if I have my dates correct, so 58 was when the pill was first introduced, is that correct? 60s when it went on the market. Okay. 50s it was being tested.
In 58, I think, is when when Pius XII died. So one, you have this turnover of popes, right? Secondly, it's going on the market in the U.S. and the U.K. soon thereafter. I don't know how widespread it was in Europe at various places at this time. So it might have been seen as more of a local phenomenon that might have been addressed with local bishops saying things first, right? There probably doesn't need to be an official document referring to a scientific discovery. That's a little bit unusual. There's not a lot of encyclicals about, here's this medical procedure, let's write an encyclical, you know. That's not generally the purview of popes. But this became such a huge social influence, right? It saw the way it was being adopted that therefore that sort of drove it. That would be my guess as to how this sort of, you know, snowballs. Plus, we lived in Italy. Things don't go quickly.
Yeah, I was gonna point out, if you need to get it, I hope that none of you ever do, but if you ever needed to get an annulment, it takes a year to do that. So 8 to get an encyclical is actually pretty quick, right? Yeah.
Yes, can I follow up on this?
Yeah.
As you were describing the process of, you know, thousands of Catholics marching in protest and apparent division and people already sort of invested in this, and
yeah,
I can't help but feel a similarity to what's going on with some of the homosexuality and transgender types of politics that are going on today, is we've got areas of the country and the world where all of this stuff is sort of being sorted out at various levels and protests within various parts of the church and the world. Do you see any lessons in this event for us today?
I think it's worth bringing up the thing that I said not to bring up.
good job, Dan. A couple of things here. I'll just throw out two history points. So when this protest happened in D.C., this was in part led by a professor at CUA, Charles Curran, who was a priest at the time, who wrote about why contraception should be fine. Seeing the church's position, the archbishop in D.C., William Baum, called Curran in and said, you can't teach this, you're at a Catholic university, I'm firing you from your job. Paul VI, there was an appeal on the basis of Curran about this, and Paul VI refused to back up Archbishop Baum in his firing of Curran. What that did was, it just took the authority of the bishops and threw it out the window. I'm not sure why Paul VI did that. I don't know if he saw, there are more problems if we go down this path. Maybe he was right. I don't know. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt there. Plus, he's doing this and not knowing the social situation exactly of being in the U.S. at the time. It's not like you have social media and you can watch all of this stuff. So trying to get involved with this is just a mess. So Paul VI sort of backed off. The message sent to every bishop was, don't stick your neck out, because you're going to have the faithful cut it off, and Rome isn't going to care.
And honestly, I think we still see the reverberations of that. This is just personal opinion, but with like not calling out Catholic politicians, I think it's because the bishops feel like they could just get their faces rubbed in the mud if they do, you know, that nothing will be there to back them up.
Right. And then, you know, soon thereafter you had... And the Canadian bishops up at the Winnipeg Conference put out a document that said, so here's the church's teaching, feel free to do with it what you want. And they weren't corrected for that. And so it just became a kind of, you know, with homosexuality or transgender, this sort of stuff, what these basically said is the church will have an official doctrinal position, but then it's just not going to talk about it very much in an official capacity. And that's really lessened the authority of the bishops. And, you know...
I think one lesson we can take, though, is that the positive one is to follow the money, you know, because there's a whole industry based off of the birth control pill. And it seems like there are probably burgeoning industries based off of, like, transgender surgeries, etc. And so if... You know, if we can look back and figure out, I'm not sure that there's been enough attention paid to that. If we can sort of figure out how to, like, not ride the tide into this and then react, but sort of figure out what's going on in advance. And probably our best example of doing that well would be, like, with the abortion industry, trying to point out that it's an industry, calling it that, you know, those sorts of things.
And I think the other big lesson to learn is, you know, just because the media logged something, or you don't have to follow that, or just because... You know, look, for 50 years we were told this was absolutely necessary, and look at all the fruits. And I mean, go watch your average television show or movie, right? Everybody has these awfully stunted relationships, right? The whole drama is about, will we develop into the adults that we ought to be, who are economically mature, socially mature, psychologically mature, right, and morally mature. That's the drama. Will I actually become responsible? And when you view a movie like that, it starts to get a little boring after a while, right? Like, you go in and go, okay, maybe we'll get there someday.
Why you won't watch romantic.
Turns out, eventually, in the end, mostly, sort of, kind of responsible, right?
And that's the one that gets the girl.
Yeah. But I think we've learned something from this. I'm not sure institutionally how well that's known. I think that's perceived by bishops and priests. But I think socially Catholics know this, right?
So one more question.
Yeah.
Have you guys noticed an increase of people who are interested in NFP who aren't Catholic for like the green sex and the organicness of it?
Yes and no. I'd say that there's traction in like non-Catholic Christian churches for what they call fertility awareness-based methods, which I would actually prefer that we stop using natural family planning as a term and just sort of let that die, because doctors think they know what that is and they don't. But I think we'd let it die, and then we talk about fertility awareness-based methods, that would be hugely helpful. Even though I just called it NFP the whole talk, so erase all that. And there are some of those. What gets tricky is when... As an NFP method, we don't want to cooperate in like even a remote evil. And so if someone comes to us and they're going to do IVF and they want to learn their circles to figure out when they're ovulating to know when to take the drugs, we have to say, sorry, I can't help you. And there has been an uptick in that. So that reproductive endocrinologists and people that are helping women get pregnant in ways that aren't licit with the Catholic Church have started sending people to NFP because they know that we know what we're talking about, even though they won't ever acknowledge that to your face, but they do send to you. And so we can't really help them. And so what you find is a little bit of tension. And there are some Catholics that have started a method called FIM, if you've heard of it. It's in Dickinson, so you'll see people who know about it soon. But it's not explicitly Catholic, even though it was developed by Catholics and most of the practitioners right now are Catholics. But it's sort of a debate amongst NFP right now because to be Creighton or to be Marquette, you have to sign like an ethics thing. And so if you're going to do FEM, you don't have to do that. Well, then it gets tricky. It just gets tricky. But we have seen some. What I find, though, is that most people who are, like, crunchy in coming to an NFP method for that reason, if they aren't Christian, are finding the faith aspect, because we do teach what the church teaches. They're finding that off-putting.
Yeah.
We're not going
to... And it might have to do, like, why you're doing this, right? Like,
yeah.
if you're doing it because you're committed ethically to this as a stance about, you know, who are we as human beings... That might drive a different response to, well, this is going to force real change in my life, versus, I'm doing this because it makes me feel better with my social circle. Oh, wait, that's not going to drive a real, you know. So it depends a lot on how much of that fat is, or that sort of movement is really grounded in making tough choices.
But I will say that sometimes crunchy people are the ones that have the best discipline because, dude, they grind their own wheat. I'm saying they. Maybe you're among them, but that's a long time to wait for bread. I don't know.
But do you guys endure, though? Like, just because people don't have to start with the best intentions,
mm-hmm.
they're interested for one reason and can see the benefits and then, like, the fruits coming out of that.
Yep, and that's the entire argument for, like, them. They're like, let's just get them in the door. We're all Catholic. We just don't have to tell them that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I was just going to say thank you for being honest with the couples that you're meeting with. We were prepared for marriage outside of this diocese, but in the Creighton Method, and I felt like it was a lot of roses.
Yeah.
And a lot of, maybe this is unique to our instructor, but I felt like our instructor also would like only give us certain bits of information, and then it was like, come back for more, because she didn't totally trust us. Anyone who knows us knows we dated for a really long time. So I really appreciate that you're honest with the couples that you meet with, because that's one of my biggest concerns, is that we as young people paint it as super rosy, and then people actually get into it and they're like, yeah, this sucks.
Yeah.
See ya. So I just want to say thank you.
Yeah, it's hard for them to talk about it.
Right? Who are you going to talk to?
Yeah,
right, yeah, because it is sort of still a topic that, like, you're not going to walk up to your friend and be like, so can we talk about this? Unless you both know that you're doing this same thing, right? So if anyone's suffering, Simcha Fisher is really funny, and Sinner's Guide to NFP is a great book. The cover has two naked people in a confessional, so that should tell you right off the bat that it's got humor in it. But it does that. It basically reassures you that you're not alone in thinking that NFP sucks, but that it's good that it sucks.
I've also thought that it's super helpful to both be able to kind of hate on NFP as opposed to being mad at each other. You know.
That's such a manly response, I think. See, I don't think of that. Let's get it together.
So instead, like you said, sometimes it can become the gatekeeper thing, but I think we found consolation in we both can get mad at the system.
Yeah.
You know, or some of the details behind it, I suppose, as opposed to I'm mad at you, you know.
One of the most therapeutic things for a couple that's going through infertility and like being super diligent about charting and tracking and things just aren't working, you look them in the eye eventually and you're like, just go tear up the chart. Like, seriously, go home, tear it up, and don't chart this next cycle and see what happens. And there's actually a phenomenon where some couples, not all, it's not a promise, but some couples, once they tear it up, that's when they get pregnant because they've been stressing themselves out so much. I mean, that's the theory anyway. So... But yeah, you're right. It's a third-party thing. It's not go home and like not care about your fertility. It's like, no, go take the chart. Like, you know, get rid of the method and love each other.
Yeah.
One more question. All right, are you guys going to hang out for a little bit? I don't know. I'll date
sure.
you to last for another half hour. So. Anyone have some burning questions?
Yeah.
Daycare, free people.
There you go. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.